It's getting easier to be green.
It really is just a matter of being open to looking around the home and finding these opportunities to not only save energy, but also save money.
That's Eric Corey Fried. We'll talk to him about the book he co-authored with Kevin Daum, Green Sense for the Home. And green building is taking off. With costs down, it isn't just good for the planet, but the wallet, too.
Certified green homes have been selling for noticeably more money and selling quicker than comparable homes with standard construction.
That's Barry Katz. He tells us about practical green remodeling. We'll also talk with green architect Betsy Pettit about the deep energy retrofit she did of her old house. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's hot out there, and many people are cranking up the AC as a way to beat the heat. The problem is, the more energy we use to cool ourselves, the more we heat up the planet. Traditionally constructed buildings are responsible for between half and three-quarters of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. But there are better ways to cool, heat, and power our homes. The more we incorporate green building practices in new and old construction, the closer we'll be to getting a grip on climate change. And building green is starting to make economic as well as environmental sense. But how do you know whether your green building project is cost-effective? Well, wonder no more. Green architect Eric Corey Fried and financial expert Kevin Daum have taken the guesswork out of 50 such home projects, from the quick and simple to the complex. Their book is Green Sense for the Home, rating the real payoff from 50 green home projects. I spoke with Eric Corey Fried about the book. Eric Corey Fried, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I'd like to start with just the simple stuff, because even though just about everybody knows about changing your light bulbs, you list some things that are a little less known. Tell us some things that people might not think about that they could do right now to get green savings in their home.
The weird part is that most of the stuff is the easy stuff. That's kind of the shocking part. In the book, we cover 50 items, and I would say that probably 45 of them are kind of things that everyone should do, even renters. But some of the easier things to do are install a programmable thermostat, something you could do in an hour, maybe. Insulate your water heater, something you could do in another hour. But then there are even kind of sillier things to do, like caulk around your windows just to create a nice airtight seal. So it's just a matter of being open to looking around the home and finding these opportunities to not only save energy, but also save money.
And that's kind of the unique approach that we have to the book, is that we've done the work for you. Not only do we make the green argument, but then go along and say, well, here's what the payback would be. Now, on most of the 50, the payback is obvious. On pretty much all of them, I think 48 out of the 50, you're kind of silly if you don't do it in your home. And in most cases, these are even things that renters could do in their home, and the payback would be worth it.
Can you give us some examples of things that renters could do, and the payback would be worth it?
The easy thing that renters could do are things that have a payback of less than a year, really. The programmable thermostats are one. Insulating your hot water heater is another one. Believe it or not, turning down your water heater to about 120 degrees is one that you could do in about 5 seconds, and everybody should do. Because, after all, 20% of your home energy bill is spent on heating water, and you'll really only use it probably once a day in the morning when you shower. So there's something that everybody should do, and there's no reason not to.
Well, you have some things also that are, I think, more advanced, probably a renter wouldn't do, but sound very intriguing. Micro hydropower?
Yeah, in the book, we kind of keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger in the scope. So a lot of people focus on solar power as a way to generate electricity, but in some cases, solar power doesn't really fit the bill. So we explore wind and micro hydro. Micro hydro is really just a fancy word for using water power. So if you live on a site that has a running stream on it, micro hydro might actually work out for you. It uses the power of the stream to produce electricity, and unlike solar, runs 24 hours a day. and in some cases runs all through the year. So there's a case that, that depending on where you live and what's on your land, it might actually work out for you.
Is it really expensive to install?
Surprisingly, no. We found it was surprisingly inexpensive, but some of the costs can also be deferred by sharing it with your neighbors, you know, kind of teaming up and splitting the costs. And, you know, two or three of your neighbors together, you could create your own, like, little mini public utility.
That sounds very attractive. And now, what are some things, let's say, that you could do in your kitchen to save energy that would pay off?
In the kitchen, there's a bunch of things. The first one is kind of an obvious one, but it's worth mentioning, which is to pick the right appliances. You want to pick Energy Star appliances, and Energy Star appliances are pretty easy to find nowadays. Everybody knows them. They're those kind of cute black and yellow stickers that appear on the appliances. But what you want to do is you want to really read the label and find the one that has the best energy rating. And there's a series of there's a list of suggestions, manufacturer suggestions we make in the book. But you can kind of do the work for yourself and just read the label. The other thing is to use the appliances correctly. Things like a dishwasher, for instance, although they're incredibly convenient, sometimes we have them, even when they're not full, we set them on the full max cycle because we want to make sure that we bust off every bit of grime and dirt and, you know, and germs and whatnot. But if the thing is only half loaded, you know, they have a short wash setting on it that you can take advantage of. The same thing's true on your washing and you know, your clothes washing machine, that maybe you don't need it on the hottest water setting. And simply by turning down the heat, the water setting, you can cut your energy bill considerably.
And you mentioned a green countertop.
Yeah, there's you know, most people are kind of envious of the granite countertop. The granite countertop has kind of become ubiquitous for a high-end kitchen. But in truth, it's kind of boring. You know, you kind of see it everywhere. So we made a bunch of suggestions of greener, healthier, more resource-efficient countertops that I frankly think are more beautiful, things like recycled glass. So we have a beautiful countertop that's made of crushed recycled glass and cement mixed together called ice stone. And it's just simply gorgeous. And not only is it probably price-wise on par with a high-end granite, but it's healthier for you and I think much more beautiful.
I've also heard of concrete, just plain concrete countertops that you can even do yourself.
Yeah, there's some wonderful kits out there. You can, if you're handy, you can make your own concrete countertops. Concrete's a great countertop material because it's so durable, and you can do an amazing amount with it. It's very plastic and fluid, and you can do incredible curves, incredible colors, incredible patterns. But it's not an aesthetic for everybody. But I really like them.
Mm-hmm. You also say that you should replace vinyl flooring with linoleum flooring. Why?
A lot of people are confused. They think vinyl and linoleum are the same thing, that they're synonymous, and they're not. Vinyl is a plastic. Polyvinyl chloride is the official name of it. And it's a very unhealthy plastic. It's unhealthy in its manufacture. It's unhealthy in its disposal. When we throw it in the landfill, it turns into arsenic and puts toxic gas into the land and the water. Linoleum, on the other hand, is all natural. It's made from linseed oil and sawdust. It's very healthy material. It's naturally anti-static, naturally anti-dust, and it's also a 50-year floor. So where a vinyl floor is only going to maybe last 10 years, a linoleum floor is your grandmother's floor, right? It's your grandmother's old floor that truly will last 50. So it's a healthier, much more durable, and I think more attractive alternative.
And is it worth it when you do the rating?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, remember, if you're going to replace an old vinyl floor with linoleum, remember, don't throw the vinyl away. Try to recycle it. And we even give you kind of suggestions of where you can go to do that.
Hmm. Yeah, your book is really well laid out, I think. Just not only do you rate the products and the payback, but you also give a lot of resources that are just about on every page on where to get things.
I didn't want to leave anything up to chance. I wanted to give everybody all the information they needed so they can just go out and do these things. I've been involved in green architecture for almost 20 years now. And what I found is that over the years, the same questions kept coming up again and again. And this book was my chance to kind of get all that out, put it down, and say, here, just go off and do it.
You've been involved for 20 years. What are, maybe if you could give us
a broad sense of what is the biggest change that you've seen in the 20 years that you've been involved with this?
The biggest change is really the perception. If you think about it, it's kind of crazy, but the environmental movement, our approach 40 years ago was, we're going to educate everybody in the country. You know, everyone in the U.S., we're going to educate all of them. That was the modern environmental movement, and we're going to get them to change their behavior, which now seems almost kind of a strange way to go about it. But that's really what we started doing. The first Earth Day in 1970 was really an attempt to do that, get everybody to be aware of these things and change how they live their life. And for the most part, it worked with a number of things. But what we found is that there's a series of things that people won't do, they won't change. Just in the last, let's say, 5 years, there's been a profound change among everybody simply because of all the other things going on, the issues around energy, the issues around the climate crisis and around carbon emissions. So because of these external forces, suddenly everybody's now catching up. In short, everybody's becoming somewhat of an environmentalist. And in the near future, everyone will address these issues in everyday life, in everything they do. And if you think about it, you already are. How you buy light bulbs, what type of gas you choose, what type of car you buy, if you walk to work, right? You're kind of making these subtle little choices. And these little choices are adding up to a much, much bigger picture.
Hmm.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking today about green home building and remodeling. Later in the show, we'll talk with Connecticut architect Barry Katz. But right now, Eric Corey Fried is telling us how to rate the payoff from 50 green home projects. His book, co-authored with Kevin Daum, is Green Sense for the Home.
So let's go back to some of your suggestions. You also talk about home projects that can be done when building new construction. People who want to, build their home, not just remodel it. You talk about advanced framing techniques. What are they, and why do they save energy?
Yeah, the last third of the book are things for people that are doing either a new built, a new home or an extensive remodel. And advanced framing is simply a take on the old-fashioned framing. Most homes are built with little sticks of wood done at 16 inches on center. But the reason for the 16 inches on center really dates all the way back to the 1850s. So what we propose is that instead of 16 inches on center, you do 24 inches on center. And it turns out everything still lines up. The plywood still lines up. The brick, the concrete block, everything still lines up. But in doing so, you're stripping a fair amount of wood out of the project. You're making the building lighter. And by making it lighter, you're making it stronger. You're also making things line up. Now the roof frame...
Wait, stop right there. By making it lighter, you make it stronger? I mean, I used to do rehab work. I was a carpenter's helper. I would have thought that 24-inch on center would make a building much weaker.
No, because here's what's happening. Instead of doing 2x4s at 16, we're doing 2x6s, a thicker wall, at 24. The thicker wall also gives us more space for insulation, so now we can insulate better on the walls. The roof framing is now lining up to the wall framing because they're both spaced at 24. So now there's fewer points of transfer in terms of the load. Everything's lining up. And there's fewer points of connection, so there's fewer points of failure. And because the entire frame weighs less, it's more dynamic and stronger. And because everything's lining up now, everything's based on this 24-inch module instead of 16-inch module, we're able to do a lot of other clever things. So at the corners, we can do two studs instead of normally there'd be three. And at the top, we instead of having a double plate, we can have a single plate. So that lighter frame means greater strength.
Wow, that's so interesting. You also talk about SIPs, or structural integrated panels. Is that what it's called?
Structural insulated panels.
Insulated panels, that's right. So what are those, and how would one build with them? I mean, is this part of this new kind of framing, or does it have a different kind of framing?
It's very similar. It's a whole other chapter, but we call them SIPs for short, structural insulated panels, and they're really fancy sandwich panels. On the outside are we have two layers of either plywood or oriented strand board or something like that, and then on the inside, 6, 8, or 10 inches of insulating foam. And the foam comes in all different varieties. There's just pure straight styrofoam, which is oil-based, to, kind of water-based, soy-based foam in the middle, and a whole kind of mess of varieties in between. But generally speaking, they're 4 feet wide by any length, and you kind of screw these panels together, and you assemble a house, and you can do it very quickly. Because what you're doing is it's the wall framing, the wall sheathing, and the wall insulation kind of all in one big sandwich. It almost looks like a square Oreo, really, if you think about it. And it speeds up construction immensely, but also gives you a very energy-efficient home.
So why wouldn't one just do that instead of any other kind of framing system?
Well, I don't know if you know from your days working, I don't know if you remember, but the construction industry tends to be very stuck in its ways. It tends to be very risk adverse, really. So they see this new thing and they get scared of it. But the weird part is that SIPs aren't new. I mean, they've been around for 20 years, but they've finally been coming into vogue, especially among production builders who kind of see the immediate advantages of doing it. Plus, the best part is that SIPs can be used not only for the wall, but you can use it for the roof and the floor.
Wow, so everything can be insulated. You can get a really tight envelope then.
A really tight envelope, and by really embracing that idea that everything's built on this 2-foot or 4-foot module, you can also reduce a lot of waste, and you kind of make the openings fit, and you can really speed construction along. And what we found is that either using the advanced framing or even the SIPs, we can cut about 30% to up to 55% of the wood out of the building just by being smarter about it.
And that would, I assume, mean less cost.
Less cost, less waste, less materials. Everybody wins.
Wow. Now, you also talk about integrating energy systems. What does that mean?
Well, most people know about solar panels. They know that, you know, they assume that they have to go on the roof, but they don't really have to go on the roof. Solar panels can go really anywhere on your site. And so what we're talking about is you can integrate them in a certain way. You can integrate the solar with maybe a solar thermal, hot water heater. You can put them as awnings on the building and shade your windows at the same time. You can put it on the front facade, and the solar panels can be part of the design of the facade. As long as they're in the sunlight and have a wire that connects back to the house, you know, you can kind of put them anywhere. So in that chapter, we really explore all the different ways you can integrate them better. One of the more obvious ways is what we call building integrated photovoltaics, or BIPVs. And the easiest example of that are the solar shingles. And they're roofing shingles that have solar panels on them. And they install like shingles. They look like shingles. They weave together like shingles. But they're all solar panels, and they're integrated into the design. So for people that don't want the appearance of just a solar panel slapped on the roof, they want something a little more integrated together, this whole chapter really explores that. And it's really, in my mind, the future of building.
And awnings. You can actually make solar panels into awnings?
Yeah, and there's different companies now that make solar panels that have no backing on them, so the panels themselves they're somewhat translucent, so the light goes through them, and so it almost looks like a tinted window, really, and you can use them as kind of cool awnings. There are some companies that make them as the windows themselves, so you can get skylights that have solar panels integrated in them. The light comes through the solar panel, generates electricity, but then you get this kind of diffused light that comes through, and it's really kind of beautiful.
And what about costs?
Well, remember, not only are you getting a solar panel, but you're also getting a solar panel plus a shingle, or a solar panel plus a window, or a solar panel plus a skylight in some cases. So in those cases, the cost tends to be about the same. What you do lose is you lose some of the efficiency. Those solar panels, because they're not oriented perfectly to the sun the way you'd ideally like them to be, they don't produce as much electricity as they possibly could. So you lose a little bit that way, but we kind of factor that into the cost and talk about that in the chapter of how you figure that out.
So what kind of help can homeowners get, or even renters, as you pointed out before, if there is any, with upfront costs of doing some of these things?
Well, for a lot of the things, there are local rebates, and we give you kind of sources where to find them. But generally speaking, for pretty much everything in the book, you might want to check first with your local public utility. Know your electric and gas company to see if they already offer rebates to encourage you to do these things. Remember, for them, the cheapest kilowatt to produce is one that they don't have to make. So if they can get you to install an Energy Star appliance, if they can get you to turn down your hot water heater or insulate it, it saves them money in the long run. So many public utilities around the U.S. are already offering these kind of rebates. Then at the local level, you might want to just call your local building department and ask them if they know of any rebates. Then on the county level, then on the state level, and then on the federal level. And the best part is in the book, we even give you sources of where to find, just for everybody, where to find all the rebates in your area for bigger things like solar.
Well, that's great. Well, it's an incredibly useful book, Green Sense for the Home, Rating the Real Payoff from 50 Green Home Projects. Eric Corey Fried, you wrote that with your co-author, Kevin Daum. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Green Sense for the Home won the 2011 Outstanding Book Award from the American Society of Journalists and Authors. You can find a link to Eric Corey Fried's website with a lot more information about green building at writersvoice.net. Now let's turn to practical green remodeling. That's the title of architect Barry Katz's new book, out from Taunton Press. Katz won an award from the Connecticut Association for Home Builders for a house he built, a traditional-looking colonial, that was voted the best green house. But while he's happy to build you a new home, he thinks retrofitting older houses is greener. Katz says old houses can be turned into near-zero net-energy buildings by using advanced building techniques together with renewable power like solar to make homes into energy generators. Payback times for many green retrofit projects are less than a year. For the big ones like solar, the payback can be as little as 3 years. And if you want to sell your green home, it'll command up to 30% more than a conventional home and sell in half the time.
Well, Barry Katz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
You won the 2007 Hobie Award for the best green building from the Connecticut Association of Home Builders. Could you explain what the Hobie Award is and what you won it for? And then tell us a little bit about your own involvement in green building.
Sure. Okay. So the Hobie Award is given by the Connecticut Association of Home Builders, as you said, every year in a number of different categories for remodeling and new construction. And the year that I won for Best Green House was, in fact, the first year that they had a Green Award. And it was for a house I built in Westport, Connecticut, on spec. And my goal with that house was to build a house that was as green as possible without looking unusual in any way. So it was a very classic New England colonial with authentic architectural detailing throughout and, you know, the kind of spaces and room arrangements that you would expect in a normal house. You know, my goal was to try and do a house that people would drive by and think, how come I never noticed that nice old house before?
So you won this award for building a new house in the style of an old house, but you've written this book, Practical Green Remodeling, to make old houses green. Why do you say that remodeling might even be a better way to go than building new?
Well, from the environmental point of view, there are a whole lot of existing houses in this country, something like 110 million homes. And the vast majority of them are not insulated particularly well, have older heating and air conditioning systems, have older appliances, and in short, these houses are not at all energy efficient. And it'd be possible to make a very large environmental impact by doing relatively low-cost interventions on existing homes. At the same time, when you remodel, you're essentially recycling a whole house rather than tearing something down and putting all the materials into landfills. So that's one of the advantages of remodeling. And that at the same time, when you're remodeling, you are making use of existing infrastructure. You know, the house that you're remodeling is already in a neighborhood that has streets and sidewalks and sewers and phone lines and all the things that go into making it possible to develop homes in an area. Whereas new construction very often takes place in new developments where a whole lot of new infrastructure has to be built. So there's great conservation of resources involved in remodeling.
We are in a time now of a kind of housing crisis. Housing prices are way down. Is it worth it to the homeowner to remodel their green home, for example, if they want to sell it?
I think it is. If you look at the cost of almost any remodeling project, what you find is that generally it never adds as much to the value of the home as the project costs. But, and this is something that's been studied in new construction more than remodeling, but certified green homes, in other words, new homes that have been certified by an independent third party as having certain green attributes, have been selling for noticeably more money and selling quicker than comparable homes with standard construction. So I think as time goes on, the market will recognize the value of green attributes, whether it's a new or remodeled home. But there have been studies in Seattle, in Portland, Oregon, in Texas, in areas where there are significant numbers of certified green homes on the market. And homes have been selling anywhere from, 12 to, in some cases, 30% more per square foot, and sometimes selling in as little as half as many days on the market.
Wow, that's quite a statistic there. Now, you write about net zero energy home. Tell us what this is.
A net zero energy home is not a home that doesn't use any energy. It's a home that has been put on a very strict energy diet. Things have been done to reduce the amount of energy the home uses, to make it as energy efficient as possible, so that then the addition of some renewable energy features, like solar panels, for example, are able to supply the relatively small amount of energy that the home uses. Typically with solar panels, they produce a lot more energy in the summer than they do in the winter, and often it's the case that in the summer you're producing more electricity than you use. In the winter you're producing perhaps not quite as much as you use. But most states now have something called net metering, which means when you produce more electricity than you use, the utility buys it back from you and credits you against the energy you use in the winter when you're not producing as much. So over the course of the year, it averages out to, in the best case, a zero energy bill, sometimes even a little better than zero. But, there are people who've got, utility bills of $5 or $7 a month.
$5 or $7 a month? That's pretty good.
It's not bad.
Now, what are some of the things that you need to do in order to make a remodel green? For example, I saw that you have three fundamentals of green remodeling. Tell us what they are.
I like to group all of the things that can be done to make a home green into three basic categories, which are energy efficiency, resource conservation, and healthy living environments. Not many people think of the health aspect of green building and remodeling. Most people talk about energy efficiency and recycled materials and things like that. But the fact is that a great many commonly used building materials today contain all sorts of chemicals that are not good to be around. They are, in some degree, hazardous to human health. Many of them we know exactly how hazardous they are, and many, many more we have no idea because they haven't been studied. So one of the things you want to do when remodeling green is to use materials that are known not to have any harmful ingredients. Formaldehyde-free plywood, for example, low or zero VOC paints and finishes. VOC stands for volatile organic compounds. They're chemicals in petroleum-based products, especially paints, that off-gas into the air, even after the paint is dry, for months and months afterwards, and you're breathing in these toxic fumes. Floor finishes, even furniture, a lot of furniture is made with adhesives and other materials that off-gas unhealthful fumes into the air. So healthy living environments, I consider one of the most important aspects. People buy homes, remodel homes, because they have a growing family. And when you consider that one of the prime functions of your home is to raise your children, I would suggest that you want that home to be as free from harmful substances as possible.
Yeah, especially since we've been hearing actually a lot of reports recently of the dangers of formaldehyde in particular and the fact that they're in a lot of building products. So you talk about kitchen cabinets, getting low non-formaldehyde kitchen cabinets. I haven't heard about plywood that is without formaldehyde. Where do you find these products?
Columbia Forest Products makes a product called Pure Bond Plywood, which is a finished grade plywood with a veneer of some kind of hardwood like maple, for example, that's used in making cabinets and furniture. That is 100% formaldehyde-free.
And is this something that's, you know, generally available?
Yes, it's readily available, and it is not any more expensive than standard plywood. You just have to ask for it.
Wow. You know, I think a lot of people probably go to Home Depot and buy their cabinets. I mean, what about the big firms? Are they beginning to offer more green choices?
Yes. Actually, if you went on the web and Googled formaldehyde-free kitchen cabinets or green kitchen cabinets, you'd be amazed at how many manufacturers pop up in all price ranges.
Builder Barry Katz. His book for homeowners is Practical Green Remodeling. We'll talk more after the break.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what was needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden. Don't you know we're gonna have a solitopia?
Lost, so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But don't you know we're gonna have solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with builder Barry Katz. Before the break, he started telling us about the three fundamentals of green remodeling. The first is using non-toxic building materials. The second is...
Resource conservation is very important. Entails everything from being efficient in the way we use lumber to conserving water to using products made from rapidly renewable materials, for example, bamboo. Bamboo grows very, very fast. You cut it down, you make flooring out of it or other things, and it's back fully grown again in 5 years, ready to be harvested again.
And then what is the third principle?
Well, energy efficiency is really the big one, and that is the one where most people look for a financial payback. And there are many things you can do, from very simple and inexpensive things like changing to more efficient light bulbs, to putting better insulation in your attic and your basement, to finding and sealing places where air is leaking into the house, where you've got drafts. That's something that's very easy to find, especially when it's cold out. It's a little harder to do in the summer, but when it's cold out, you can just dampen your hand with a little water and run it around the edges of windows and doors, and you can feel exactly where air is leaking in. And with a tube of caulk or for slightly larger gaps, a can of expanding foam from the hardware store, you can seal up these gaps and make a big difference in not only the cost of heating the home, but in the comfort, because air leakage creates cold spots in homes and drafts that make us uncomfortable.
Talking about ventilation, one of the things that you talk about, Barry Katz, in your book, you talk about creating a very tight envelope. How does one keep this very tight envelope from having the house build up too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere or building up with toxins that are coming from materials that maybe one hasn't replaced with greener ones?
Well, that's a great question. And this is an area where two fundamentals come together, energy efficiency and healthy living environments. First of all, for most existing homes, to add some insulation and to seal up the air leaks that you can find is not going to make the house so airtight that you have to worry about not having enough fresh air. But in a more extensive remodeling job, when you are really insulating and sealing the whole house very well, and perhaps putting in new, tighter-fitting windows and doors, then what you want to do is make the house as tight as possible and then add ventilation at a controlled rate.
How do you do that?
Sometimes it's as simple as a small exhaust fan with a little louver that lets fresh air in, but a better way to do it is with something called an energy recovery ventilator. An energy recovery ventilator replaces the air inside the house with fresh air at a controlled rate that you can set depending on the size of the home. But ideally, you want about 8 complete air changes in 24 hours. And that's very easy to accomplish with a good energy recovery ventilator. They're sometimes also called heat recovery ventilators, and known for short as either ERVs or HRVs. In many older homes that are drafty, you might have as many as 50 or 100 air changes in 24 hours. So essentially, you're heating that whole volume of air that fills your house 50 or 100 times, when really you only need to heat it 8 times in order to have plenty of fresh air. So making a home as airtight as possible and then adding mechanical ventilation is sort of the best of both worlds. You get the maximum energy efficiency, and you also get plenty of fresh air. At the same time, adding air filters to the ventilation system can improve the air quality even further.
I asked Barry Katz about whether there were energy-efficient ways of having large windows or sliders in a home.
You can get highly engineered glass that will cut heat loss dramatically. There's a company called Sirius Materials, which makes the highest efficiency windows and glass in the country. You know, typically when we insulate a wall, you might insulate the wall to R19 or R24, but most windows are somewhere in the R1 to R3 range. So essentially, from a thermal point of view, the windows are just big holes in your house where the heat is constantly escaping. But with this new type of glass, it's called heat mirror glass, you can get glass that is in the R5 to R10 range, which is incredible for glass and makes an enormous difference.
And that's all you get also, say, with triple pane or double pane windows? You don't get much more efficiency?
Well, when you're comparing it to the fact that, you know, ordinary windows, even the best name brand off-the-shelf windows you can buy at Home Depot will have, at best, an R value of about 3. So if you're going from R3 to R5, that's a very significant percentage change in the amount of heat you're losing.
So now, you mentioned a few green materials that you can use to remodel your home, like bamboo, and now these kind of new windows. What are some technologies that might be coming online fairly soon that will make remodeling even more of a payoff?
One of the biggest things on the horizon is in the area of lighting. Everybody knows these days about compact fluorescent bulbs, the swirly-looking bulbs that use a lot less electricity than the standard incandescent bulbs. You know, regular light bulbs, regular incandescent light bulbs, are extremely inefficient. 90% of the energy that goes into them is wasted as heat. That's why the bulb gets so hot. Compact fluorescent bulbs use much less energy to produce the same amount of light. But new on the horizon is something called LEDs, which stands for light-emitting diodes. One of the disadvantages of compact fluorescent bulbs is they contain a little mercury, which is not really a problem when you screw in the bulb, but when they start ending up in landfills in large numbers, it could become a problem. LEDs contain no mercury. They last much longer. An LED bulb can last 20 to 25 years and is fully dimmable, which compact fluorescents are not, and use even less electricity than fluorescents. At the moment, they're still relatively expensive, but prices are coming down, and a number of manufacturers are coming out with LED bulbs in various shapes for lamps, for overhead lights, things like that, that are very good replacements. And if you look at the life cycle cost of how much you're paying not only for the electricity over the lifetime of the bulb, but for the number of bulbs you would have had to replace if you just had standard bulbs, the numbers work out. The LEDs, even though they're expensive up front, do save money over time.
Mm. That's great. I wish we had more time, actually, to talk about your book, Practical Green Remodeling, Down-to-Earth Solutions for Everyday Homes. It's a terrific book. It's beautifully illustrated as well. And I want to thank you so much, Barry Katz, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you, Francesca. It's been a pleasure.
Go to writersvoice.net to see a picture of the award-winning house Barry Katz built in Connecticut. Next up, we'll talk with another green architect who did a deep energy retrofit of a home, her own. now, let's hear a report I did in 2009 about green retrofits. I spoke with architect Betsy Pettit about what older homes can teach us about saving energy and about the deep energy retrofit she did on her own home, a Sears Kit house in Massachusetts. Pettit plies her trade with Building Science Corporation in Boston, Massachusetts. I started out by asking Betsy Pettit what older ways of building homes can teach us.
The big obvious one with our single-family homes is the size of homes. Up until the 1950s and 60s, our single-family homes were really typically around the 1,000-square-foot size. And as we got into the more affluent 70s and 80s, we really started increasing the size of our homes so that we went from average home sizes of about 1,100 square feet to up to right now in the United States over 2,500 square feet. And certainly we're building larger homes than that in a very high percentage as well. And that given on our single family home, because we're exposed to the exterior on so many more sides, really the larger size homes simply use more energy to keep comfort conditions inside. So we're now moving towards a trend to make sure that people understand that size matters. But this really makes the retrofit of existing homes even more important. We had a trend for a while in the more wealthy neighborhoods and the upper scale communities to tear down existing homes on lots that were really the right size for that size house. And this has been known as the McMansion building trend. And we would like to encourage that retrofit of that home and really using the space that those homes encompassed more efficiently and effectively.
I used to live in an all-electric home built in the 1970s, a square box with low ceilings and not very good insulation. In the brutally hot summer of 1988, I felt like I was suffocating. Pettit says older homes had the ability to cool themselves through porches and by spacing windows in a way that encouraged flow-through ventilation. She says homes built in the 70s and 80s like mine forgot all about that.
If you look at the homes built before 1950, and the Sears Kit homes are a wonderful example that were distributed all over the United States between 1900 and maybe 1920s. They often were compact in size, but they had two windows in every room. Rooms were designed such that they happened in corner locations. Rooms opened up to other rooms that allowed and really encouraged the air to come in at the lower level and to exit through the upper levels of the house. And we forgot that as we started building tract homes in the 70s and the 80s and really were just focusing more on churning them out. We also, of course, at that time didn't understand well the impact of insulation in our exterior walls. So that house that you're speaking of more than likely had bad insulation in cavity walls that really didn't effectively fill those space and didn't act very well as insulation. So that insulation would have effectively helped keep the heat out as well as keeping it in.
Insulation is something where there have been a lot of new developments. You know, typically the old houses, even if they had, you know, were south-facing or had flow-through windows, the winters were pretty cold. Is there anything we can learn from the past in terms of insulation? And what are we bringing to insulation now that could help retrofit these homes?
Early in the development of the insulation that we used in our houses, it typically tended to be a loose blown product that at least did fill voids. And when we got to the 60s and the 70s and the advent of the inexpensive insulation bat, we really had a backwards movement, if you will, in terms of the insulation actually effectively keeping our houses warmer. But insulation in general has improved dramatically over the years. And so the things that contribute the most to the energy use in all homes, all single-family homes across the country, is heating. And the biggest contributor to heat loss in homes is air leakage. So the most effective thing that we can do in our old houses is to stop the air inside of the homes that we've paid money to heat, to stop that from uncontrollably leaking out of our homes due to small and large holes that we build into them.
Even though you can use new technologies to make a home energy efficient, the simple fact of building a new home uses more energy than taking an existing home and retrofitting it. I asked Betsy Pettit, what's the best way to do a retrofit in order to minimize leaks and maximize efficiency?
Really, the most important function is to air tighten the houses, stop uncontrolled air leakage. You might want to look at the window-to-wall ratio in terms of how much window do you have. So our older homes had quite good use of windows in that they often, and I'm talking about the pre-1950s, where we often had a window-to-wall ratio of 15%, and yet those windows were well distributed around the house to promote ventilation. We would want to use or put in some kind of a controlled ventilation system and to use some energy recovery with that.
And what does that mean?
Well, that means you might want to provide air changes would be with a mechanical fan. Heat recovery would pull all of the heating energy out of the air as it is being moved out of the house and redistribute that heating energy into a house. And the typical mechanical piece of equipment to do that is a heat recovery ventilator. You might want to change your windows because our modern windows are much better at keeping uncontrolled air out of the house and also providing comfort as we get closer to them because they have higher ability to withstand heat loss.
And when you say windows, what are some, you know, kind of basic rules for siting windows?
This is something that we used to know and we need to know again. When you're designing a new home, you want to design the rooms in that new home such that each room has at least a window on two sides. And that's going to allow flow through ventilation to help cool the house or to provide air change in the house when the temperatures outside are such that you'd like that temperature in your house. But they also provide for natural light in a house. So again, if you go back to a typical Sears house design such as the four square, every room had light from at least two directions that was provided by the windows. And so you could live in that house during the day without needing to turn on lights, and you could live in that house in the spring and the fall and open those windows and not need to provide mechanical heating or mechanical cooling or mechanical air change.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're hearing an interview I did in 2009 with architect Betsy Pettit. It was part of a series I produced for Sea Change Radio about what older technologies from a lower carbon past can teach us as we move into a post-carbon future. The series was called Back to the Future. Betsy Pettit told us about the deep energy retrofit she did in her own home.
This was an old Sears 1916 four-square house that I purchased in 2003. And at that time, the energy use was quite high, typical of a house of that size, oil-fired boiler and an inefficient hot water tank. The retrofit was changing exterior shell from virtually no insulation to what I like to call 10, 20, 40, 60. And that's really an easy way to remember the retrofit our values of what we liked, we'd want to go to in our as we move to retrofitting our homes. Our 10 for under the slabs in the basement, our 20 for the below grade walls, our 40 for the above grade walls, and our 60 for the roof. One of the things that was important about that is also taking old unlivable spaces that already had material to build them but were not comfortable spaces, basements and attics specifically. And this retrofit added the additional square footage of the basement by making it warm, dry, and comfortable, and also additional square footage in the attic by making it warm, dry, and comfortable. A lot of our attics in New England enclose a lot of space already, but we can't live there because they're not conditioned and they're not insulated. But they often have windows and they often have very high ceiling areas so that one could make them into usable space. This is another way of just adapting our older homes to our new way of living, rather than adding additions, which people are wont to do with a small house. Look at the existing spaces that are already enclosed and just finish the enclosure by adding insulation, sometimes a window, maybe that's not even necessary. So this house, this four square that had 2,000 square feet, now has 3,600 square feet of usable square footage while using a quarter or an eighth of the energy that the original house used.
A quarter and an eighth just by adding the insulation?
By adding the insulation, changing the windows to higher performing windows, and upgrading the mechanical systems from inefficient to efficient.
Are you still using oil?
No. The first thing I would do in an old house is take the oil tank out of the basement and change to to natural gas if you have it. If you don't have natural gas, there's a whole series of things that you might want to question and look at using. Certainly we don't promote using electric baseboard heat for heating our homes. It's the least efficient way we can provide heat for our homes. But if electricity is your only source of energy, we now have air-to-air heat pumps, which really squeeze all the heat out of the exterior air that possibly can and change it such that we can use it inside to heat homes. That's an effective way to use electricity if you have to for heating your house. But, of course, really changing the balance point of the house, that is making it a lower balance point, making it such that the temperature has to drop a lot lower before you have to turn heating systems on, is what the effect of adding the insulation and better windows and reducing air leakage does. And in fact, in this house, that was the major push. Plug the holes, take out the old inefficient windows, replace them with more efficient windows, and add our value to all six sides of the cube where there was none before.
And how did you get underneath the slab?
We did it on top of the slab. So the existing slab has insulation added to the top of it and then a new slab poured.
And so you're doing all this even without adding anything like photovoltaics or anything. What is your heating bill?
The heating bill last year was 600 therms. Now that was for heating and hot water. 600 therms at about $1.50 a therm was about $900. You know, we're down to 99 cents a therm now, so it's much lower this year, but I haven't done the final bill for this year. The cost of doing all of those things, just the energy costs, was about $70,000. If you look at the mortgage cost of spending $70,000, maybe $4,500 a year, at a 4.5% interest, and the savings from the old electric and oil bill were approximately $4,300 a year. So it's what we would call very close to cost neutral to make those kind of changes.
But you're still paying a little bit more in the sense that your costs are $4,500 a year for the mortgage and you're saving $4,300. So you still haven't broken even.
Haven't broken even per se. But of course, this will get into the whole cost of money and how we calculate whether something is cost effective or not. So all that has to happen is the cost of gas goes up by a small percentage, and all of a sudden that is cost neutral. And we know that's going to happen.
And were you able to get any, I mean, are there subsidies out there for people also to bring down that cost?
There are subsidies out there. I didn't, because I did this in 2003, they weren't available. Now, for instance, all of the utility companies in Massachusetts are working on programs to promote doing low-energy retrofits. And we're working with National Grid, for instance, in Massachusetts, who has a program that they will offer up to $40,000 in matching funds for homeowners that want to try to really achieve these really higher energy cost reductions.
Well, that's great. I mean, that would cut your cost down by more than half.
Yes, that's exactly right. We also have the federal government is really working to develop programs as we speak, given the latest bills out in Congress and the ones that they're currently still debating over, but giving some level of tax relief to homeowners as they retrofit their homes. For instance, things that are in consideration are, you know, up to $4,000. If you do certain measures, there's maybe a direct tax credit of up to $4,000 for making energy retrofits to homes. This is still really in formulation, but the one thing is clear. The federal government now gets it that it matters what we spend to heat and cool our homes and to make ourselves comfortable inside, and are in the process of shaping programs that can help promote and encourage that type of work to be done.
Well, Betsy Pettit, your website is buildingscience.com. This has been a fascinating discussion. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We've put a link to pictures of Pettit's house at writersvoice.net. You can also read the case study of how she did the retrofit on her home. And a note, since I did that interview in 2009, programs to help homeowners do green building projects have come under threat. For example, the new debt ceiling bill that was just passed will slash domestic spending. It's in doubt whether programs like that will survive.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.